Campus FM presents the second part of the Lenten Reflections by Father Brian Pierce, entitled From Darkness to Light, Disciples of the Paschal Christ.
Good evening. We began our reflection yesterday by reflecting on the paradoxical play between darkness and light. Light born from darkness. I'd like today to begin with a reading from the Gospel of John, chapter 9. As Jesus passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "Neither he nor his parents sinned. This is so that the works of God might be made visible through him. We have to do the works of the one who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world." When he had said this, he spat on the ground and made clay with the saliva. And he smeared the clay on the eyes of the man and said to him, "Go now and wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. So he went and washed, and he came back able to see. His neighbors and those who had seen him earlier as a beggar said, "Isn't this the one who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "It is," but others said, "No, he just looks like him." He said, "I am." So they said to him, "So how were your eyes opened?" He replied, "The man called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and told me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went there and I washed and I was able to see." And they said to him, "Where is he?" And he said, "I don't know." They brought the one who was once blind to the Pharisees then. Now Jesus had made clay and opened his eyes on the Sabbath day. So then the Pharisees also asked him how he was able to see. He said to them, "That man put clay on my eyes, and I washed, and now I can see." So some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, because he does not keep the Sabbath." But others said, "How can a sinful man do such things?" And there was a division among them. So they said to the blind man again, "What do you have to say about him since he opened your eyes?" And he said, "He is a prophet." Now the Jews did not believe that he had been blind and gained his sight until they summoned the parents of the one who had gained his sight. And they asked them, "Is this your son whom you say was born blind? How does he see?" The parents answered and said, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind. We do not know how he sees now, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him. He is of age and can speak for himself." His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jewish authorities. For the Jews had already agreed that if anyone acknowledged him as Messiah, he would be expelled from the synagogue. For this reason, his parents said, "He is of age. Question him." So a second time they called the man who had been born blind, and they said to him, "Give God the praise. We know that this man is a sinner." He replied, "If he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I know is that I was blind, and now I see." So they said to him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He said, "I told you already, and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?" They ridiculed him and said, "You are that man's disciple. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but we do not know where this one is from." The man answered and said to them, "This is what is so amazing, that you do not know where he is from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if one is devout and does God's will, he listens to him. It is unheard of that anyone ever opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he would not be able to do anything. They answered and said to him, "You were born totally in sin, and you are trying to teach us?" They threw him out of the synagogue. When Jesus heard that they had thrown him out, he found him and he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He answered and said, "Who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said, "You have seen him, and the one speaking with you is he." The man answered, "I do believe, Lord," and he worshipped him. Then Jesus said, "I came into this world for judgment, so that those who do not see might see, and those who do see might become blind." Some of the Pharisees who were with him heard this and said to Jesus, "Surely we are not blind, are we?" And Jesus responded, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But since you say, 'We see,' your sin remains." The blind man in today's gospel is a nobody, a sinner. He's invisible to the world. Human history has always had a sub-story, the story of the less than human. And this is always the favored story of God. Jesus saw the blind man as he passed by that day, because Jesus always sees the one that the world doesn't see. And he called this blind man to a fuller life that day, to be his true self, one made in God's image and likeness, formed from the dark clay of the earth and filled with the light and the breath of God. The spittle and the clay that Jesus molded together that day are symbolic of a new creation, recalling the Genesis story when God formed Adam from the clay of the earth. Jesus recreates that day this man born blind. "Behold, I make all things new." It was Jesus' word that called this man from darkness to light. Not so unlike Paul and Ananias that we heard about yesterday. And in the words of the poem by David White that we just heard, the blind man himself discovers that life is no passing memory of what has been, nor the remaining pages of a great book waiting to be read. It is the opening of eyes long closed. It is the vision of far-off things. It is the heart, after years of secret conversing, speaking out loud in the clear air. It is the man finding himself astonished, opened at last, fallen in love with solid ground. Thomas Aquinas, great theologian, medieval theologian, who just so happened to be a Dominican, said in one of his writings, "So that the divine light might be seen by us, Christ healed our eyes, making of his flesh an ointment, so that the ointment of his flesh, the Word, might heal our sight." Jesus, in this gospel story today, invites the blind man to be healed, to discover, uncover his true human dignity, his true self, to be born again in the waters of new life. In the letter to the Ephesians, we hear, "For you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Live as children of the light." To be a Christian is to encounter this liberating light. It is the opening of eyes long closed. Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk whom I quoted yesterday evening, has what is perhaps for me the most profound definition of sin that I have ever found. Merton says that sin is our refusal to be who we are, a rejection of our mysterious and spiritual reality hidden in the very mystery of God. Our refusal to be who we are. Adam and Eve hid from God. They covered themselves over, refused their inherent God-given beauty and goodness. So, in a sense, their sin was their refusal to be who they were. In another poem by David White, the Irish poet, he says this, "Sometimes reading Kavanagh," another famous Irish poet, "I look out at everything growing so wild and faithfully beneath the sky. And I wonder why we are the one terrible part of creation privileged to refuse our flowering." Sin is to refuse our flowering. Merton says in another writing of his, he says, "The core of our being is drawn like a stone to the quiet depths of each moment where God waits for us with eternal longing. But to those depths, the false self will not let us travel. Like stones skipped across the surface of the water, we are kept skimming along the peripheral one-dimensional fringes of life, because to sink is to vanish. To sink into the unknown depths of God's call to union with Himself is to lose all that the false self knows and cherishes." We all, in some way or other, struggle with this blindness of our false self. We live this shallow self that skips along the surface of life. Medieval mystic Meister Eckhart says that to let go of yourself and to let God act with you and in you is God's will. This work of letting go is God's work. It's God's word. This birth belongs to God. In another of his sermons, he says, "If I should have gone out of myself and were entirely empty, then indeed the Father would bear the only begotten Son in my spirit." Both of these quotes of Eckhart are inviting us to fall to those depths, those dark depths of God. When Saul, in last night's reading, placed his hands into the hands of others and let himself be led to Damascus, he let go of the false self and dropped to the depths of God. Nicodemus is, I think, one of the more fascinating figures in John's gospel. He only appears at the beginning of the gospel and again at the end. And he visits Jesus at the beginning of the gospel in the third chapter of John's gospel at night. He hides behind the curtain of night, even though his heart longs to know the light of day. It's as if Nicodemus isn't ready yet to be who he truly is. So he hides by night. The beautiful reality, we never hear about Nicodemus again, the rest of the gospel, until the very end at the crucifixion. And what is powerful is that Nicodemus in John's gospel is one of the two, along with Joseph of Arimathea, who go in the middle of the day to take down the body of Jesus from the cross. we know nothing about the process that Nicodemus has led, but we see a man who once hid behind the curtain of darkness at the end of the story, coming out in the light of day and saying, as the blind man in today's gospel, I am. I am one of his disciples. In that chapter 3 of John's gospel, Jesus says, this is the judgment, that the light has come into the world and people loved darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. But those who do what is true come to the light so that it may be clearly seen that their deeds have been done in God. Nicodemus is one of those disciples. But in order for this to happen, we have to seize these moments of grace. As we heard yesterday in a quote from Timothy Radcliffe, we have to turn to the light. From the David White poem again that we heard, that day I saw beneath the dark clouds the passing light over the water, and I heard the voice of the world speak out. The opening of eyes long closed. In chapter 8 of John's Gospel, the chapter immediately previous to the story of the blind man who was healed, Jesus says these words, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. When you lift up the Son of Man, then you will realize that I am. Jesus then said, if you remain in my word, you will truly be my disciples. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Our encounter with Christ, therefore, is an encounter that is supposed to remove the masks of our false ego, our false self, and liberate us to be truly who we are, so that we, too, can speak out loud the words that the blind man speaks when they ask him, are you the one or are you not? And he says the very same words that God spoke to Moses from the burning bush and that Jesus speaks throughout the Gospel of John, I am. Making the name of God his own name, as if to say, I am filled with God. This is what happens to Nicodemus when he comes out into the light at the end of the story. He proclaims to the world, I am. Thomas Merton again says, in returning to God and to ourselves, we have to begin with what we actually are. We start from our alienated condition because we are prodigals in a distant country and we travel far in that region before we seem to reach our own land. Merton says we have to begin where we are. We have to begin in the darkness and make the journey into the light. And in order for this to happen, we have to have the courage to face the darkness. The darkness of our own unfinishedness, our own sin, our own hiding behind the curtain of darkness. A psychiatrist in the United States who died a few years ago, a man by the name of Gerald May, who wrote several books and founded the Shalom Institute in Washington, D.C., speaks about this encounter with our unfinished self, our broken self, our sinful self. And he speaks of it as precisely that encounter which allows us to begin what Merton calls the journey back home. Gerald May says this, although God calls us toward a more perfect life, we cannot personally achieve this state of perfection. We can and we should do our very best to move in that direction, struggling with every resource we have. But we also have to accept the reality of our incompleteness. Second, we need to recognize that the incompleteness within us, insufficiency, unfinishedness, whatever we want to call it, that this incompleteness within us, our personal insufficiency, does not make us unacceptable in God's eyes. Far from it, he says, our incompleteness is the empty side of our longing for God and for love. It is what draws us toward God and toward one another. If we do not fill our minds with guilt and self-recriminations, we will recognize our incompleteness as a kind of spaciousness into which we can welcome the flow of grace. We can think of our inadequacies as terrible defects, if we want, and hate ourselves. Or we can think of them affirmatively as doorways through which the power of grace can enter into our lives. This is what happened to Paul and Ananias in yesterday's readings. They allowed the grace to flow into the unfinished parts of their hearts. Gerald May goes on to say, through this spaciousness will come some homeward call, similar to what Merton says, an invitation to transformation. And if we answer yes, as did Paul, even with the tiniest, most timid voice, our struggle becomes consecrated. Consecration means dedication to God. In the beginning of this process, we will be unable to grasp the overarching cosmic meaning of our small yes, the joy it gives to God, the deepening love it will bring to humanity, the universal covenant it has enriched. But there is love in this yes and hope. We feel a small breeze of freedom. And in that tiny space deep within our hearts, we say, yes. The man born blind in today's story, in his encounter with Jesus, allows the grace to flow into his incompleteness. He says yes to Jesus. Do you want to be healed? Go to the pool of Siloam and wash yourself. Yes. He accepts. He opens up that doorway into the broken darkness of his heart, and grace flows in. He says boldly afterwards, I am. Aware of his God-likeness. A Benedictine monk from France who went to India in the 40s and lived the rest of his life in India, known by his Indian name, Abhishiktananda, said that it was at the baptism in the Jordan River that Jesus really experienced profoundly the disappearance of the separation between himself and God, the disappearance of the dividing chasm. And he says that it is in the spirit that Jesus understood the voice which called him son. And when Jesus replied, Abba, he realized that in this Abba, he and I are one. This is the first time in the Gospels where Jesus really says out loud in the clear air, I am. His true self shines at that moment. In spiritual language, especially in the East, in the Orthodox tradition, this process of moving from the darkness of our unfinishedness to this fullness of the light is what they call divinization. In the East, this is a very common theme in the spiritual journey, that we actually move into a divinized state to the extent that we continue to yield this broken part of ourselves open to that inflow of grace. Thomas Merton again says, there's a deep resonance in the inmost center of our spirit, in which our very life loses its separate voice and resounds with the majesty and the mercy of the hidden and living one. God answers himself in us, and this answer is divine life, divine creativity, making all things new. We ourselves become God's echo and God's answer. So our baptism, like Jesus' baptism, and like the baptism of the man in the born blind in the story today when he goes to wash in the pool of Siloam, is a moment that reveals to us our deepest self, our true self, our essential self. This revelation brings with it, though, a responsibility. That is why in the gospel story today, the pool of Siloam means sent. We are baptized not just to say, I am, but to be sent on mission. This is our prophetic vocation. And it is given to us at the very moment of our baptism, the moment we receive the light of Christ. So we are then, as baptized Christians, called to be bearers of the light, bearers of the truth that has been given to us. Jesus says in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 10, what I say to you in the dark, tell it in the light. And what you hear whispered, proclaim it from the housetops. So there's a movement here from the awakening to our true self, the awakening to our divinized self that we've been made in the image of God. We are then called to move forward with that light and give it away to others, to shout it out from the housetops. On December 1st, 1955, in Montgomery, Alabama, I'm from the southern part of the United States, where Martin Luther King Jr. is from, and Rosa Parks, who I'd like to mention to this evening. On this day in 1955 in Montgomery, Alabama, Rosa Parks, who was a seamstress at the Montgomery Fair department store, she was 43 years of age at the time, she who had all her life gotten on a bus early in the morning, gone to the department store, worked all day as a seamstress, gotten on the bus to come back in the evenings for years and years and years. She was active in the beginnings of the civil rights movement in Montgomery that had already been formed a few years before. On this day, December 1st, 1955, on her way home from work, the buses in those days in my country were divided into three sections. The front section was for white people. The middle section was for white people unless there was an empty seat, a black person could sit there. And the back section was for black people. Rosa got on the bus that day in December of 55, and the only open seat on the bus was in the middle section, so she sat down. She had a right to sit in that seat. But the law said that if a white person came on board, the black person had to give the seat up to the white person. And this indeed happened. And a white man came and stood next to her, visibly upset that she wasn't moving. The bus driver heard the ruckus from the front of the bus, stopped the bus, called the police, and Rosa Parks was arrested. That night, a gathering of black pastors and people in the civil rights movement asked Martin Luther King Jr. to be the leader of their movement, and the story continued from there. But that day turned our nation around. And it was nothing but Rosa Parks speaking out loud, I am. I am a human being. I'm made in the image of God. I'm filled with God just like you, and I too have a right to sit in this seat on the bus. Many years later, in an interview, Rosa Parks said, since I've always been a strong believer in God, I knew that God was with me that moment, and only God could get me through the next step. In the letter to the Ephesians, there's a phrase that says, awake, O sleeper, and arise from the dead. Rosa awoke that day from the dead and claimed her dignity as a Christian, as a woman made in the image and likeness of God. And she spoke her truth from the housetops. Julian Bond, a member of the NAACP, the national group of people of color in our country, said at Rosa Parks' funeral, which was just a couple of years ago, he said, Mrs. Parks was much, much more than just the bus woman. Rosa Parks shifted the gears of the universe her entire life. Timothy Radcliffe, whom I also quoted last night, the former master of the Dominican Order, in a talk he gave years ago, spoke about truth. And he said, truth is about keeping one's eyes open so that we do not miss a thing. But, he says, that can often make our eyes smart. Our study, a discipline of truth, should be a discipline that opens our eyes. And then he goes on to say, but it's not enough to just see these places of human suffering as if we were tourists of the world's crucifixion. Strong words. We are not to see these places of human suffering as if we were just tourists of the world's crucifixion. He says these places are where theology must be done. We must dare to see what is before our eyes. We must believe that it is there where God seems most distant and where we are tempted to despair that the church must do theology. Do we see with those kinds of eyes? And do we dare to say the truth out loud, to speak it out from the rooftops? In the last years living in Lima, Peru, I attended a week dedicated to human rights at the Catholic University in Lima about 4 years ago. It was a week where they had cinemas on human rights and displays and talks. And one of the things that the Catholic University in Lima had that week was a photo exhibit of children of Peru. It was 30 or 40 large panels of black and white photographs of children, during the war, orphaned children, malnourished children, abandoned children, et cetera, et cetera. So it was all these different, and each panel was sort of dedicated to a different theme. And frequently, under some of the pictures, they'd have the name of the child and a small quote from that child. Many of these pictures were taken during the 20 years of war in Peru from 1980 to 2000. And there was one face of a young boy, a 9-year-old boy. I don't remember the name, but I remember he was 9 years old, that caught my attention, and I went up to look at the picture closer up, and underneath there was this quote from this boy. And the quote in Spanish was, saben que existo, pero no me ven. They know that I exist, but they don't see me. Those words went through my heart that day. They know I exist, but they don't see me. And I thought to myself, this boy is probably in some figures of the United Nations Children's Fund, and in figures and charts on poverty in Peru and children in the world. But no one sees this boy except the contemplative eyes of a photographer. In Mark chapter 10, I'd like to read a small story about Jesus' encounter with another blind man. They came to Jericho, and as Jesus was leaving with his disciples and a sizable crowd, Bartimaeus, a blind man, the son of Timaeus, sat by the roadside begging. On hearing that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out, saying, "Jesus, Son of David, have pity on me." Many rebuked him, telling him to be silent, but he kept calling out all the more, "Son of David, have pity on me." Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." So they called the blind man, saying to him, "Take courage, get up, he's calling you." He threw aside his cloak, sprang up, and came to Jesus. And Jesus said to him, "What do you want me to do for you?" The blind man replied to him, "Master, I want to see." "Go your way," Jesus said, "your faith has saved you." And immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus on the way. Jesus stopped. I think it's the heart of the story, those two words, Jesus stopped. Another translation says, Jesus stood still. It was a crowd of people in the desert between Jericho and Jerusalem. Lots of pushing, lots of people, cries from the sides of the road, along with Bartimaeus's. In other words, it was a bit chaotic, the situation at the time. And on top of it were the group of those people close to Jesus, surrounding Jesus, that were screaming at the beggars and the blind and the lame to shut up and mind their own business. Leave Jesus alone. He's got more important things to do than to be bothered with you. So in the midst of all of this chaos and noise and dust moving along on a road, Jesus stopped. If there is any more powerful image of the contemplative heart of Jesus, I think it's this one. A heart that heard a cry that nobody else paid attention to. Jesus saw the one that no one else saw. And then he asked this man a question that no one had ever asked him. "What could I do for you?" I think that had this man never seen physically again, even that question was what set him free. He was healed by the question. No one had ever spoken to him. No one had ever treated him like a human being. And all of a sudden, Jesus says, "Can I do something for you?" In that moment, the light explodes in his heart. It's as if he knows for the first time he's a human being. And though the words aren't in the text, we know that he's screaming out with every fiber of his being, "I am. I exist. Someone sees me." I had the privilege to live for a period of time in the same priory in Lima, where St. Martin de Porres lived, one of our great, very humble brother saints, a black man born of a black freed slave woman and a Spanish conqueror. Martin was born in 1579, and at the age of 15, went to the Dominican priory in Lima and lived for 60 years as a Dominican brother. Many of you have probably heard of him and know some of the stories associated with his life. He was a very humble brother to the poor. There's a story told about Martin by a brother that happened to walk into the dining room one day, the refectory of the priory, when Martin was in there. And Martin didn't hear this brother come in behind him. And the brother tells the story in the beatification process of Martin. And he said as he walked in, Martin was standing there looking at the floor where a dog and a cat were eating from the same bowl of soup. And the brother says that he was surprised to see this image of a cat and a dog eating at the same plate. And Martin standing there smiling, watching this. And he says that at that point, a small mouse popped its head out of a hole in the wall. And Martin turned to this mouse and spoke to it, saying, "Little one, do not be afraid. If you are hungry, come and eat with the rest." And the mouse came and began to eat at the plate. This image appears often in iconography of Martin de Porres. Martin standing there with a dog, a cat, and a mouse at his feet. And usually people say, "Oh, isn't that cute? Little Martin with his broom and the dog, the cat, and the mouse." But I don't think it's a story about cuteness at all. I think it's a story about seeing, about prophetic seeing, about a man baptized who took his baptism seriously and saw what no one else saw, the one who was left out, the most forgotten one. In other words, what Martin speaks to the mouse is what Martin spoke to everybody in his day, the poor, the broken, the wounded, the black slaves, the Indian slaves of his day. Martin was always saying to everyone, "Little one, do not be afraid. You too have a place at the table." Martin always was aware of the one who was excluded from the table. St. Paul says in Ephesians, "In Christ Jesus, you who were once far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ, for he is our peace. In his flesh he has made both groups into one and has broken down the dividing wall." This wall that divides us, that separates us, that keeps some excluded while others eat plentifully at the table. Paul says in Christ there are no more walls. There are no more crumbs thrown to the dogs or to the mice for that matter. Martin understood this truth with every fiber of his being. He understood that God's table is for everyone and that every creature under heaven has a right to eat at the table. Martin grew up as a black man in a world that had no room for black people. As a child, he was called a mulatto dog by the people that saw him in the streets. Even some of his own Dominican brothers called him a mulatto dog. But because he knew what it meant to be excluded, his eyes were opened, and he saw always the one who was excluded. So what about us today? Do we see that? Have our eyes been healed not only to discover our own human dignity, but to see the one who is excluded, the one who lives hidden behind the curtain of darkness? I have followed in the papers the last couple days the tension, perhaps would be the word, around Bishop Mario Grech's comments in the Times on April 4th. I think that was Saturday. The Bishop of Gozo. I just quote a piece of his words. "What convergence is there between what we profess to believe and our treatment of refugees and immigrants in our midst? If we must be honest, it would seem we are failing this test." Now listen to his imagery of seeing. "Are we turning the other way so as not to see? Are we opening our eyes in rolling up our sleeves to come to the aid of those who need our help. Today I had the privilege of being invited to visit the Marsa Open Center and have lunch there, and found myself in a world that seems very similar to the world that I come from. I grew up after most of the laws excluding black people had been changed, but nonetheless in a world where black people have usually been pushed aside, and more recently Latino, Hispanic people as well. And I went back after that to look for the article by Bishop Grech and was amazed and gratified to see his words about, do we turn away so as not to see? How do we respond to these important issues in our day? How do we respond to the gospel of Matthew 25 when Jesus says, I was a stranger and you welcomed me, unless we first are healed of the blindness that lets us hide behind a curtain of sin? At the end of the story that we heard today of the man born blind, the Pharisees come to Jesus and they say to him, surely we're not also blind, are we? And Jesus responds to them, if you were blind, like the man born blind, you would have no sin. But because you say, we see, there remains your sin. Their seeing was a looking at that condemned the blind man. They denied the blind man the fullness of his own human dignity. They looked at him, scoffed at him, but they didn't ever really see him with the eyes of God. Timothy Radcliffe's words again, it is not enough just to see these places of human suffering and be tourists of the world's crucifixion. In the Bartimaeus story, there's a very important detail at the end of the story. It says that after his healing, Bartimaeus followed Jesus on the way. In other words, he who had been healed of his own blindness, he who had discovered his own dignity through his encounter with Jesus, now committed himself to go along the way with Jesus to do what Jesus had done. In other words, he was taking his baptismal gift seriously. He was now committing himself to walk with Jesus and to bring the light of Christ to others. This is what our baptism is about. It's to walk with Jesus along the way and do to others what Christ has done for us. Give us the light that sets us free. Archbishop Romero, whom I quoted also yesterday, the martyred Archbishop of San Salvador, said in 1979, just a few months before he was assassinated, he said, if someday they take the radio station away from us, where his homilies each Sunday were broadcast throughout the country, if someday they take the radio station away from us, if they close down the diocesan newspaper, if they don't let us speak, if they kill all the priests and the bishop too, several priests had already been killed by that time, and you are left a people without priests, each one of you must become God's microphone. Each one of you must be a messenger, a prophet. My voice will disappear, said Romero, but my word, which is Christ, will remain in the hearts of those who have received it. Romero was saying, it's not about a bishop. It's not about the priests. It's that each of us have been baptized. Each of us have been anointed to be prophets. Each of us are on the way with Jesus. Each of us bears the light and has a mission to share that light, to enlighten others with that light. This is what it means to follow Jesus. Dorothy Day, the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, said that that we offer hospitality to the poor not because it might be Christ, but because it is Christ, she says. We start by loving them for Christ, but then we learn to love them for themselves, each a unique person. So, sisters and brothers, I ask us this evening, how do we open our eyes to see our neighbor? How do we allow our baptismal anointing to become a reality in our lives? How do we break down the dividing walls that separate us to make room in God's house for all people who don't fit into the dominant, acceptable categories that our world sets up? Are the handicapped visible in our world? Where are the mentally ill? Is the political refugee offered safe haven? Do we remember that criminals are human beings and need a place for healing and rehabilitation? I remember years ago when Mother Teresa of Calcutta visited the very famous San Quentin prison in California. I was studying in California at the time. And they took her to death row, and she went up and down from cell to cell on death row. And when she came out of the prison, there was, as usual, hundreds of reporters and cameras and microphones waiting for her. And they asked her about her visit. And she said only one sentence: "Whatever you do to the least of these men, you do to God." Mother Teresa saw the neighbor. So who's missing? Who's the one like the small mouse who hasn't found him or herself invited to the table? Who doesn't feel welcomed even in our churches today? Is there a place for the deaf and the blind in our religious services? Do those who have suffered the tragedy of divorce know that they have a place at the table? What about gay men and lesbians? Do we just throw them the crumbs as if they were dogs? Where are the single mothers and fathers, pregnant teens, the elderly, the mentally ill? Where are those with AIDS? Are they seated at the table? Or do they say, like the small 9-year-old Peruvian boy, "They know I exist, but they don't see me"? Years ago, in the 1990s, when I was living and working in Honduras and Central America, our community worked with a community of Mother Teresa's sisters at an AIDS hospice. It was a place for those people who had AIDS, who were found in the streets, to come and die a dignified death. Most of them lasted weeks or a couple of months. They usually came at the very end of their lives. And one day I went to the hospice to visit with. Every day there was new people there, and we'd go from bed to bed and chat with them and talk with them. And then a couple of days a week we would celebrate the Eucharist. And I noticed there was a very tall black man who had not been there the day before. And he was sort of halfway lying down on his bed, halfway sitting up. And I went over and sat down and chatted with him a little while. And I asked him if he knew that we would be having Mass an hour later. And I explained to him where the small chapel was, about 40 steps from where he was. And I said, "You're welcome to come to Mass if you would like." So I visited a few more people and went and got ready for Mass, and Mass began. And it was always a little bit of a circus, these masses, because the crippled would come in and beds and wheelchairs, and it was trying to find room for everybody and get everybody settled. And so it always took a little bit of time for everything to get going. Mass began, and about halfway through Mass, I noticed this very tall man, the one I had spoken with, come in with a cane, very crippled, barely walking, and he sat in the very last pew, the bench of the small chapel, a chapel not even half the size of this room, very small chapel. Mass went on, and communion came, and I began to give out communion, not paying much attention. It was, again, wheelchairs and beds, and almost, when almost everyone had come to communion, I noticed that this man stood up in the back pew and with his cane started coming forward. He was a very dignified-looking, very tall man, I remember. And when he was about two people from receiving communion, someone who was a regular, who used to volunteer at this hospice, stood up and grabbed this man by the arm and pulled him out of the line and sat him down in a pew. And I just remember feeling the violence of this moment. And of course, I couldn't make a big scene right there during Mass. So after Mass, I went up to this woman that had done this, and I said, "Could you explain to me what happened at communion?" And she said, "That man is not prepared to receive the body of Christ." And I said to her, "Did you see his face as he came forward?" I said, "I saw his face. And I remember that face to this day." I said to her, I saw the face of a man who was coming home after many years away. She didn't see his face. She didn't take the time to look into his eyes and see the hunger of a heart that was saying, "Here I am, finally, back home." Do we see the neighbor? Or do we hide behind a curtain of laws and darkness and fear and half-truths? Martin de Porres spoke to the small mouse looking out of the hole in the wall. "Little one, do not be afraid. If you are hungry, come and eat with the rest." Thank you.
You have just listened to the second part of the Lenten Reflections by Father Brian Pierce, entitled From Darkness to Light, Disciples of the Paschal Christ.